Thank you very much. And look, it's always a pleasure to be here, especially it seems like you always have some fantastic scenery. Here, Mike just walked in the room, Virginia Beach. I remember spending some time down there at some of your meetings. And it is my pleasure to introduce my brother. I have a few slides to kind of introduce the concept. I will tell you that it's been about 30 years since I started working with my brother. I was a college student, and he sent me up to Alaska to work for his airline. And I got to learn at the tip of the spear what customer service was all about. Literally the tip of a spear, because there were people in Alaska carrying around these Ulu knives, I believe. And they would try and get on the plane with the knives, and I'd have to go down there and like try and defuse the situation. Half of them were intoxicated by the time they got on our midnight flight. And whoever his ops person was had made this terrible decision to have the flight leave at 12:05 a.m. Now, in the days of electronics, works out fine today because you know my flight leaves in 3 hours. It tells you that update. Back then, though, everything was paper. And so if you had a reservation to leave Anchorage, Alaska to Seattle, Washington at 12:05 a.m. on September 27th, about 10% of our people every night would show up on the 27th of September to check in for their flight that left exactly 22 hours and 5 minutes before. You got the problem? And we had ground ops that we outsourced to another company, and this was an airline that David had started called Morris Air. It was based in Salt Lake City, Utah. It was his first of, I think, six airlines that he started. Morris was sold to Southwest Airlines. David went to go work for Southwest and then left and then started JetBlue. I guess in the interim, WestJet up in Canada. I don't know if there's any Canadian folk, but we started WestJet and then went back and started JetBlue and then Azul, which went public a few months ago down in Brazil, and now TAP, which was the nationalized airline of Portugal, and he somehow convinced the Portugal government to take it private. And so I guess that's number five. But anyway, this was the first one. It was Morris Air. And we were just trying to compete with Delta and the big carriers. And I'm sure a lot of you experience that every day, trying to compete with these big, powerful brands. And we knew that the only way we could get by was on customer service. And so I was the person that was assigned to take care of and try and defuse all these situations. And the problem was is that we also needed to make some money, right? And the deal was that if you were a full fare standby, meaning you came up to the counter and said, I'm going to pay the $300, you got to be at the top of the standby list. If you were a change fee standby, and they would write it on the ticket, CFSB, then you only had to pay $20. That meant you missed your flight the night before, usually, because you thought it went out that day, and it didn't, because it went out at 12:05 a.m. And then you were lower priority than the full fare standbys. You kind of get the dilemma. And the good news was is that there was going to be another 20 people that would miss a flight the next night, so you could put them on. But the bad news was we were the cheapest deal in town. Because to do a walk-up ticket, even back then in the late 80s when I was working for him, early 90s, it was still $500, $600 to fly from Anchorage to Seattle with a walk-up ticket. And so I would every night have to look 5 to 10 people in the eyes and say, look, you're not getting home tonight. You missed your flight. I'm sorry. We're going to do our best. It'll be standby. Some people may get drunk at the bar and not show up for the flight. We can get you on the flight. And it was this crazy time. And that's when I think at the tip of the spear in customer service. About once a week, I'd have to call up David and say, look, man, my life is in danger up here. We're rescinding the full fare standby rule. I don't care about your earnings for this week. And I'm going to tell the full fare standby people we don't have any seats, so I can blow out all these change fee standby people, get them back to Anchorage, and then we'll restart the thing the next night. And so I was at the tip of the spear. I had decided when I was a young kid I was going to go to medical school. So as I was continuing to work with David, I had a little bit of this business, medical school, business, and then he solved the problem by selling the airline to Southwest Airlines. I got a year of severance. I matriculated into med school, and David went off to work for Southwest, and then that kind of started his career in the airline industry. But from day one, what I've learned from him is that at the very end of the day, the companies that can deliver the best customer service can always take down the Goliaths. And that's what he did. That's what he did at Morris Air. That's why he stuck it to Delta for so many years. That's what he did when he went to Brazil. And he went in there, and there were some formidable competitors, and he just provided the best customer service, and that's what I think he's doing in Portugal, although I haven't been on the Portugal flight yet. So let me give you a little bit of other background, just really quickly about HealthEquity. So many of you are our customers. Thank you for your business. Believe it or not, we're approaching almost 3 million households now that we serve with HSAs. We manage over $5 billion of people's money. I'll come back to that in a minute because we have this unique engagement. I'm not sure, DeAndre, I was talking last night. I know you're chief marketing officer. I don't know what percentage of your folks come to, you're in marketing, but in marketing, excuse me. Sorry, Marianne, you're a chief marketing officer. But I'm not sure what portion of your people come to your website every month, the health plan website. Most health plans tell us it's less than 10%. We actually have about 30% of these 3 million families that come to our website every month. And it's typically to pay a bill or to look at their investments or whatever. So we have this engagement, and so we try and provide this great experience. And I would argue that as you're thinking about how to engage with your members, one of the ways to do it is through their pocketbook. Because if they have to go pay a bill, that's a great way to kind of engage with them. We work with over 34,000 employers and approaching about 100 health plans in total. All of you have seen these lines. I would argue that if these lines didn't look like this, but they were more parallel to each other. This is the increase in premiums and the increase in workers' contributions to pay for those premiums compared to normal inflation and normal CPI increases. If these lines weren't doing this, we wouldn't have health reform. All of this stuff we've heard about for the last week and the last since 2010 wouldn't exist if these lines were parallel. Now, I will also tell you, I presented last week at the Stanford Medicine X conference with Intermountain Healthcare. Their plan, Select Health, is not here today, I guess, right? But their head of benefits at Intermountain, they have 70% adoption in HSAs. They showed a similar slide, except this line was their increased adoption in high deductible plans and HSAs among their employee base. And their trend was down here, and they say they've had a flat trend for the last 5 years. So I do think this can provide a solution because you get people engaged. So there's these national mega trends that's going on throughout the country, right? We do think there's mass adoption of these high deductible plans. How do you deal with them? Higher life expectancy. I was born in the mid-60s, well, a little bit towards the end of the 60s. The average lifespan of somebody that would have gone into Medicare when Medicare was passed in 1966 was about 68 or 69 years old. So the government had this fantastic deal. They would collect Medicare taxes for 45 years, pay it out for 3 years, and the guy would die, usually of an MI, because he was probably smoking, right? That was a good deal. The average lifespan now of a man in America is 79 years old. So we've added 10 years on our lifespan. Guess what else we're doing during those next 10 years? We're doing everything from titanium hips to stents in the heart. We never used to do that stuff. Women, you have the benefit of living until you're 83 on average. And so there's this increased life expectancy. And the other thing is the consumer use of technology in healthcare is a rapidly increasing trend. I was reading a thing where even people that are in their 70s and 80s use their devices for healthcare more than you know, certainly people that are younger than them. So in our world, this was from the Kaiser study in 2016. About 19% of people in commercial insurance are in health savings accounts plans. Another 9% are in HRAs. So we're at about 30% in high deductibles. You know, we think it could go faster, but you see that starting to go up. I mentioned earlier that we manage about $5.4 billion of people's health savings at HealthEquity. The 2016 numbers for the whole industry was $37 billion. We're at about 15% market share. And so as this number keeps going up, projected by 2018 would be to get up over $50 billion. This is money that people are sitting on to pay for their health care. They can invest it, they can grow it, and they can pay it back to your providers. And so these are all things you need to think about. I had a discussion earlier with Kevin, I think, about just how do you make it simple for someone to sign up for one of these accounts and to pay their doctor. And so you need to invest in technologies that make that payment really easy. And then, you know, we believe that some of this flattening of trend that you've seen in healthcare lately is like in the Intermountain example, equated to higher adoption of these types of plans. So a couple other things, and then I'll invite David up. So if a couple retires this year, and they both happen to be 65 years old, it's estimated that it will cost them about another $250,000 just to die in the current healthcare system. These are out-of-pockets, high deductibles, whatever, anything that's coming through Medicare. So the question I would ask all of you is if that's you, and you take that out of your 401k to pay for those out-of-pockets, this is just for healthcare, how much does it really cost you? It's probably going to cost you closer to $350,000. By the time you get taxed on it. If you take it out of an HSA, it's $250. So one of the biggest drivers for why people need to embrace these is that you get a huge savings when it comes to paying for out-of-pocket care. You need to bring $350 out of your 401 or $250 out of your HSA. We think there's this evolution. Most members today are spenders. We're starting to see more people become savers. Of our $5.4 billion in HSA deposits at HealthEquity, about $800 million of it now is invested. So we have roughly, you know, $4.6 in cash. That's for the spenders because they need to spend it. They need to pay their bills. About another $800 million of it is invested. Once people start to invest that money, their mindset changes dramatically because now it's their money, it's their nest egg. And then I think a lot of the things that you're thinking about, transparency, telemedicine, wellness, all starts to now matter to them because they want that money to grow faster because it's the best way to save their money. So, new popes, changing world. Top slide was in 2005 when they brought in the previous pope. In 2013, this is what's changed. All of you, I'm going to guess virtually, I think everyone in this audience probably has a device, a smartphone in their pocket. We need to do better at giving people timely, personal, and relevant information that matters to them at the moment of care. I've got this grand idea, if any of the partners in the audience or anyone wants to talk about, that when somebody checks in at their doctor's office and they do an eligibility check, we collectively should be messaging that person before they even see their doctor, because we have their eligibility. We know where they are, either through a Google locator or because the eligibility check went up and confirmed where they were. And we should say, 62% of the time, this doctor is going to send you away with an order for an expensive lab. Here's your five choices. Tell us where your doctor should send it, and here's the variance in cost. This is data that you have access to. Why aren't we sending it to people before they even see the doctor? That's my, Melissa, maybe we can develop that together. Because I know, and if it has to all be to Sharp Docs, that's okay. But it might be better to go to the cheaper ones. Oh. I mean, are there cheaper Sharp Docs than others, aren't there?
Not really.
They're all the same? they're all expensive?
Not with the same quality.
There's an industry partner out there that's doing this thing called Smart Shopper, where if you choose a given doctor versus that one, they'll put $250 right in your HSA just by going to this doctor versus that doctor. A lot of you are doing, this is an example of one of the companies that's doing telemedicine, Live Health Online. This is a way to engage the consumer. We're trying to do a lot more on the mobile phone to drive consumerism into the mobile. Right now, with our app, you can not only pay your bills, check your balances, but now you can invest right off your mobile app. We think we need to do better at messaging the member on lower cost alternatives into the app. Now, all of this, I think, is around this concept of a disruptive innovation. When Clayton Christensen wrote The Innovator's Prescription, if some of you read the book, Innovator's Prescription, it's kind of Clayton's healthcare approach to these disruptive innovations that have swept the industry. I was first introduced to the innovator's dilemma and then the innovator's solution for more general industries. And in the innovator's dilemma, they talk about Southwest Airlines and even airlines like JetBlue that came in and disrupted the status quo, were able to come in and change the world. When Clayton wrote the innovator's prescription, he asked me to help him write the chapter on HSAs. But if you think about disruption, it's taking a product that maybe people don't necessarily see as the best product. You know, maybe it's the higher deductible plan or something like that, and all of a sudden it disrupts the whole marketplace. I'm suggesting that there's a way to disrupt the marketplace by engaging the consumers, making them care again about why they're spending everyone else's money, and that'll change the way they do business. When I was in medical school, I learned, well, first Benjamin Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned, or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. When I was in medical school, I heard that every ER patient deserves a CT scan. I heard when I was in my surgical training, never let a little skin get between you and the diagnosis. And I heard a chance to cut is a chance to cure. I'm suggesting that is the old school way of thinking, and we can bring this on. So, an intro to David. When I started the company, I said to him, David, and we were kind of getting ready. This was in 2002. I went and met with him. JetBlue had just gone public. When did you go public, JetBlue? Early spring of 2002. April of 2002. He had me fly out to New York, and I met with some of his private equity guys. In fact, it was George Soros' firm, right? And I laid out my business plan. And it was to engage consumers by giving them a bigger stake in the game and to give them, you know, by definition, they had to have a higher deductible, but they also got this spending account. And I laid it out. This was in June of 2002. And David said to me, how much is it going to cost you to kind of get your proof of concept out there, to get your first customer? And I said, I think about $2 million. And he said, here's the deal. I'm going to give you a couple of requirements. You need to go do some sort of actuarial study. And I was lucky to find someone that did that. He said, I'm going to send you an article that I want you to read, and you have to incorporate it into the DNA of your company. The article had come out in August of 2001 in the Gallup Management Journal. And that article was called The Constant Customer. And if any of you like a copy of it, I'd love to send it to you. Just message me or Dennis, and I'll send it to you. We make every person at Health Equity read this as their first rite of passage. And what the constant customer says is that you have, if you can do three things within your organization, three things, you will create these passionate customers. And the person that contributed this article later ended up developing the Net Promoter Score. So a lot of you probably use NPS, right? So the author said there's three things that will drive high net promoter scores. First thing is everyone that works for you has to be an ambassador of your brand. You know, if they don't kind of believe in what you're doing, they ought to go get another job, right? And you have to help them become ambassadors. The second thing is you really need to strive for flawless execution. In the airline industry, it's on-time planes, no lost bags, high customer service, right? In healthcare, it's no loss claims, right? Right? Whatever. And the third thing is actually the most remarkable part of this, is that if you mess up or someone feels like they've been wronged in some way, and if you can fix it quickly, they'll actually be more passionate than had you never messed up in the first place. Now, here's the wonderful thing about healthcare. I knew this as I practiced for 12 years as a trauma surgeon. People always feel like things are messed up in healthcare. Right? It's either their body. And so if you can be there as their advocate, you can turn things around really quickly. So constant customer. The third thing was David said, if you raise $1 million, I'll match you. And we were able to scratch together the million, and that's where we were kind of off to the races. Now, Steve knows this. Steve Lindsay, who's here, ran our operations for a long time, and now he's leading our kind of our partner relationships. And Steve ran all of our member services. And when we started to scale, I said, Steve, I'm going to give you a magazine. And he had this magazine stapled or kind of pinned up to his cube for 5-6 years. 9 years. because, and David's going to talk about this, you can ask him questions about it, but just as David was taken off and everything was going great, they had the ice storms of 2007 in Kennedy on February 14th, right? Valentine's Day. I kind of went into President's Day weekend. And David came out, and I remember actually flying on a JetBlue flight, and I was, and David was on David Letterman explaining how on earth people got stuck on planes for how many hours?
8 hours.
8 hours. I mean, it was the ultimate chance to recover. And David came out with a thing that I think you called the Passenger's Bill of Rights. First airline to do this. Customer's Bill of Rights. And look, and we all knew in the airline industry that you could always blame God. In fact, we would say, we're not going to protect you because this was an act of God, right? We're not going to get you a hotel room. We're not going to protect your flight. You know, it was an act of God. Well, David came back and said, look, even if it's weather, we're going to protect you. And then lo and behold, a month later, St. Patrick's Day came, same ice storm, same result, kind of. And this article came out, which I'm sorry, David, to bring this up, but this is part of all of us at Help Us Deal With This. So this was the Business Week article from March 1 of 2007. And they had JetBlue down as one of the four customer service champs, and then somehow they were able to scratch it out before it went to print. So this was a really tough time for David. And what I was, and I went to some actually healthcare meetings around that time, and I heard one of the moderators say, what David Neeleman did when he stood up and said, we're going to be for our customers and give them a Bill of Rights, even in the face of natural calamities like ice storms, was the most courageous thing. And then he went on Letterman. And when I was on the flight, I was watching, I saw him on Letterman. I'm at the back of the JetBlue flight, and then pretty soon I saw every single TV. As you know, JetBlue was the first company to have live satellite TV, turned to David Neeleman on David Letterman, getting grilled by Letterman over this whole thing. So he's had a remarkable career. The epilogue to this story is that in 2017, TripAdvisor ranked his new blue, Azul, down in Brazil, the third best airline in the world, behind Emirates Airline. And we know what, you know, the Saudis have so much money, they just, like, they give you a filet mignon on every flight. Singapore, similar, you know, there they cane you if you complain, I'm kidding. And then Azul was number three, and they've got the Master Chef Award and the Best Time on Performance in South America. So with that, I'd like to invite David up, who David's just been a wonderful mentor of mine, and we'll have a little discussion, and we'll have some time for Q&A.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate that introduction. It's nice. Okay, so I was interested at dinner last night. I was interested in hearing that you had a speaker yesterday that talked about building these clinics that he had.
Oak Street Clinic.
Yeah. So here's somebody who built a business from kind of nothing with a great idea. And then I heard this remarkable comment that his net promoter score was like 92. I don't think that even exists. I mean, you guys know how Net Promoter Score works, right? It's really hard to even get a... In the health industry, I'm sure it's hard to even get a positive number, you know, from a positive number. So, you know, here's someone who came up with just a good idea, executed it well, built a better mousetrap. You know what they say about building a better mousetrap? If you do that, people will beat a path to your door. And now has, what, 23 clinics? And, you know, I think what's, you know, getting back to this constant, you know, customer article, for those of you that read it, what he starts out by saying is that there are some companies that just grow faster, are more profitable, and do better. And so his whole study was basically trying to figure out what was the special sauce in these companies that grew faster. And there was actually a comparison in there between Southwest Airlines and United Airlines. You know, at that time, Southwest had market cap that was greater than all the airlines combined. They were growing faster. And so it was the research to figure that out. And so that's, you know, I've been fortunate to surround myself with great people in order to create these types of companies. But the cool thing for all of you is that you can actually do that. You know, you can create a company that is a special company where people just love, you know, interacting with you. And, you know, again, going back to that article a little bit and just giving an example of how it would work, you know, how it works in our company. You know, Steve said that you want to make sure you hire people that are ambassadors for your brand. It's kind of opposite of that. You know, you have to create a company where people love the company, you know, and if you don't, obviously you have to hire great people, and that's obviously important, but if you can't hire great people and then treat them like, you know, treat them lousy, like crap, and then expect them to be ambassadors for your brand. And so, you know, at every company that I've started, you know, I have this mantra that says, I want this to be the best job you've ever had. You know, when we have orientation on the first day when people come to work, you know, we stand up in front of them. And I used to do every single orientation. Obviously, it's a little harder to do today. But, you know, I stand up in front of them and I said, look, I want our big goal here is we want you for 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, you know, we want you to tell your grandkids, you know, when you retire one day that was the best job you ever had. And so, you know, that's really what we do every day. And that's, and it has to do with, you know, training your leaders to be servant leaders. And, you know, there's so much involved in it. But when somebody, it all kind of boils down to the fact when you give someone a piece of logoed apparel, a t-shirt or some golf shirt or hat or something, that they want to wear it proudly. You know, they want to go to the, you know, restaurant or whatever and have people say, oh, you work for that company. I remember one time I was up in Buffalo, New York, and one of our crew members said, I just love working for this company. I just love it. And I go, she goes, I'm actually a celebrity because I work for JetBlue. I said, really? I said, how so? Well, when I go to the bank to cash my check, they go, oh, you work for JetBlue? What's that like? And then I'm at church, and somebody yells from the pew, hey, JetBlue, I love you guys, you know. And so she goes, I just feel special for working for the company. So, you know, being an ambassador for a brand means a lot, but it means, you know, hiring great people, but also creating an environment in the company where people just love coming to work every day. And they look forward to it because they have leaders that treat them with respect and are developing them and treating them really well. And creating servant leadership. And as I've gone into different cultures, as I've gone from kind of, you know, the United States to Canada, you know, to Brazil, when I got to Brazil, I was like, you know, I had learned Portuguese. I was actually born there because my father was working there. So I had Brazilian citizenship, and that allowed me to start the airline. But then I went back as a missionary and relearned the language. But I really kind of just knew how to speak kind of, you know, conversational Portuguese and kind of church-related, gospel-related Portuguese. I didn't really know.
Gringo Portuguese.
Yeah, well, it wasn't gringo. It was more just like conversational. But when you started talking about stock options and, you know, profits and, you know, balance sheet and all income statement, all that stuff was, I didn't know those words. Interestingly enough, our word for profit, you know, in English, you know, can be a man that speaks to God or you know, an amount that's left on the bottom of the, in Portuguese, it's, you know, profeta is the guy that speaks to God, and lucro, like filthy lucre, you know, that comes from the Latin root, is what you make in money. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy. So, you know, as I was trying to learn the language and the business terms, I went to our people and I said, okay, Brazilians down there. I go, okay, I want to talk about servant leadership. How do you say servant leadership? They go, what does that mean? I go, you know, a leader that serves. Well, leaders don't serve. Leaders mandate. I go, no, it's like, you know, serve. You want to take care of your people. Well, that's not how it works here. I go, well, we're going to have to create a whole new culture around servant leadership. And so, you know, that's, and then in Portugal, it's even worse. I mean, these people, you know, if you feel like you're in charge over there, it's a license to abuse people. So, but it's changing a culture and making it, you know, something different. And, you know, the culture that we've created at Azul is just unbelievable. I mean, people are, you know, I get emails daily, this is the best job I've ever had. And that's the mantra, this is the best job I ever had. And everywhere I go, I just want to let you know, this is the best job I ever had. And so creating that ambassador for the brand is hugely important. Now, flawless execution, you know, I've got this saying that says, trust but verify. You know, I'm cool with trusting people, but I've noticed sometimes that people like to hide bad news. And so, you know, what I do is I create metrics in the company that I can tell by the heartbeat of the company every day how the company's doing. And then that information is shared with everybody. So everybody knows what the information is. So we have a little dashboard with key points. So, for example, our call center, I get 4 reports a day that tells us exactly how many calls we received, what the percentage of abandon rate is, the average wait on the phone call. And so it, you know, alerts everybody if it goes over a certain level. And everybody sees it. So there's no call center guy that's hiding the statistics because everybody sees the numbers. We actually have a statistic that tells how many minutes it took the last bag to get to the airport, to the carousel. Why is that important? Well, because you can have a flawless experience with a flight, and the last thing, if you go wait 45 minutes for your bag, what's the last thing you remember? So we have a report every day that tells you when the last bag, if all the flights were that took more than 10 minutes after the plane blocked in for the last bag to get to the carousel. And so we know that information and it's shared with everyone. And so, sales data, all this kind of stuff is on this particular dashboard. And so it's transparency and making sure that everybody's accountable. And so trust but verify. So that's very important and having flawless execution. You can't stand here in front of a conference and say, we have a great airline, we do a great job, and then it's like, man, that guy is completely in the dark. His people don't even tell him what he's doing. Because I know that because I have all the statistics. So last year, Azul was the number one on-time airline in the world. We flew 94% on time. Because we do little things to make flawless execution. It's, for example, we have awards for each station if you can what we call get minutes back to the system. So every plane's scheduled for a 30-minute turn. As it comes in, it's scheduled for 30 minutes. If that plane's running late and you turn the plane in 30 minutes, you don't get minutes back to the system. But if you can turn that plane in 20 minutes, you get 10 minutes back. And so the stations that have the most minutes per flight back to the system get a huge award, and then we have a huge award ceremony where everybody's recognized for what they do. And so if a flight could start out on time, but it gets right back on time, start out late, but gets back on time, and so we get minutes back to the system. You know, I just tap, this government-owned airline for 73 years, pulling my hair out, dealing with new stuff, trying to change things, trying to deal with unions that, hate the company, and the company hates them. They actually gain minutes to the system. You know, every time a plane comes in, it has a 45-minute turn, they turn it in an hour and a half, and I'm like, hey, you just lost 45 minutes. So they were 55% on time, in 1 month this year, and so we're changing, all that. But flawless execution comes with monitoring and making sure that you trust but verify, but everybody has a common goal and everybody works together for that common goal. And then as Steve said, making it right with the customer. I mean, you have to figure out a way to know who you made mad, and you have to figure out a way to be able to make it right with them.
On the net, you do Net Promoter down there?
We do, yeah.
So on the Net Promoter, the beautiful thing about Net Promoter is one question with a follow-up. It's on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the highest, how likely are you to refer this blank to a friend or colleague, right? That's the Net Promoter score. And the guy that did it, Fred Reichheld, in fact, the contributor to the article, said, look, you can go out and hire these big customer service firms. It'll charge you millions of dollars. He said, they hate Net Promoter because they know we've totally blown them up with one question. Now, the follow-up question, though, is, and why did you give us that score? Right? And I think,
So what we do is we fly about 80,000 people a day, at Azul. And we send out about 15,000 surveys, and we get 8,000 back. So we have up to the second Net Promoter scores. In fact, our director of operations has in his office, he has Net Promoter score because we have questions that talk about, so we know where that person left from, what airport they left from. We know what flight they were on. We know who the flight attendants on that flight were. We know who the pilots were. And so we give Net Promoter Score by airport, by individual flight attendant, we know what their net promoter score is. And then we recognize them every year. We give them a special colored scarf to wear every year, the ones that are in the top 5%. And they're recognized, go a gold scarf throughout the company as the premium net promoter score, you know, person in the company. So it's a huge event. We have a huge award ceremony, and they're crying and tears and all that. You know, Brazilians are such an emotional people. So, but we know, you know, with exactness exactly where we stand, you know, every day. And we know, you know, it was an incredible thing that happened. I mean, our flight attendants have a net promoter score that are in the kind of mid-80s, which is kind of impossible. I mean, it's really difficult. But because they're so good, nobody ever says a bad thing about them. And then they know, too, because they know that one in every eight people on this flight is going to get a survey, and half of those people are going to respond. So I better be acting, because, you know, it's accountability. It's all about, there's not even a word in Portuguese for accountability. You know, we had to create a new word for accountability because there was no accountability. And so, you know, the other thing about Brazil is that nobody ever trusted the people. They wouldn't give people on the front lines the ability to make decisions. So just that transfer of power, saying, look, you make the decision, and we will stand behind you. Now, if you made a bad decision, we'll coach you and let you know why that was a bad decision and help you understand why you shouldn't do that again. But, you know, we'll give that power to you. And, you know, I was on a Gold flight one time, my competitors, before we started flying, you know, and I got to the airport 28 minutes before the flight. And the just security was there. I could see the plane. It hasn't even started boarding yet, and they wouldn't check me in. I go, why? And they said, we have a policy against checking people in 30 minutes before the flight. And I said, well, the plane's right there. It hasn't even started boarding. It hasn't, you know, it's still deplaning, and they wouldn't, you know, bend the rules. And so at that minute, I said, well, this, you know, this has got to change. Well, we're going to be running people to the gate, you know, at the last minute, as long as we don't delay a flight, you know, as long as we can get them on the plane to do it. So, you know, it's really important, you know, to have that information and to have people accountable and to be able to kind of have that feedback and to have that information to make, you know, a great company. So
let's say someone gives you a bad net promoter. Do you do anything specific to the person, the passenger, to try and regain their business?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we know, I think the surveys are anonymous, you know, from the site. I mean, obviously we have when someone complains, there's a mechanism for them to easily complain.
Right.
And, you know, we have, you know, we just like we had at JetBlue, we have set things that if a flight's an hour late, we give you credit off your next flight. So starting with a flight being late, we start sending you credits and telling you, hey, we're apologizing. So every single person gets information from us. You know, the biggest challenge we have is that travel agents don't share that information with us about their personal data because, you know, they don't want to. So we do a very good job of intercepting people on the airplanes and getting their data so we can talk to them and get back to them, because we want everyone to hear from us if there's an issue. And that's part of making it right with the customer, is that I've had people, we provide free bus service from Campinas, where our headquarters are, into São Paulo. So we've had flights that were running late where they missed the free bus. We knew they were on the bus, and so we had car services waiting for them to take them to their houses, and they actually got to their houses sooner than they would have had the flight been on time. So, you know, just doing all those things to make it right, because, you know, if you dazzle somebody, then they'll tell 10 people. I mean, the goal is that you want to have somebody be a more loyal customer for having a problem with you than if they had never had a problem in the first place. That's kind of the goal that you want to do. You want to dazzle them in such a way they go, wow, you guys are serious about customer service. I'm going to go tell 10 friends to fly on you guys. But, you know, I mean, you know, when, and just kind of from a global perspective, you know, how can you do this? Well, you know, 8 years ago, we started this airline, and it had zero revenue. There was, like, no revenue whatsoever. And, you know, we started into a market that only had 50 million travelers a year, a country. At the time, you know, Brazil has 200 million people. The United States has 300 million people. Obviously, people in the United States make more than in Brazil. But there were 750 million people traveling by air in the United States, and Brazil had 50 million. Like, this is ridiculous, you know? And so we got down there and figured out that there was an issue. Fares were really high and service was really lousy. You know, there wasn't a lot of flights between cities that people wanted to go to. So we actually took that business from 50 million to 100 million. We added 50 million passengers, and then we took half of those. So we had 50 million, 25 million customers that we fly every year.
So your competitors love you too.
Yeah, they do, except they all lost value because they had to lower their fares and they weren't nearly as efficient as we were. I mean, what we actually did to kind of create our own market is we went into a lot of cities that they weren't even serving. So, and we didn't take that for granted. So the fact that we're the only airline serving a city, you know, we could just say, you know, you want to fly with us, you know, that's the only thing you got going. But then we, you know, I've got this, you know, I tell our people too much overkill is never enough. So we want to give them great service. You know, I fight with our revenue management guys because they're always trying to raise the fares too high, and I'm trying to get the fares down a little bit, guys. And
that's their
underwriters. Give them great service.
Those are your underwriters.
We've got, you know, live TV on every plane, you know, all that. So we take great care of people. But the company today has, we have more destinations than any other airline in Brazil. We have more flights, daily flights, than anyone else in Brazil. Even though our market share is only about 18% on kind of the measure that the industry standard uses, which is an RPK, revenue per passenger kilometer, we do 30% of all the revenue in Brazil. So we outperform. Our average fare is $40 higher than anyone else, because we have higher average fares because we fly where they don't. And then, you know, our market cap is, you know, over $3 billion, and, you know, our competitors, who's 50% bigger, has a market cap that's $1.4 billion. So we have twice the market cap with a lot lower, you know, market share, because we're just more profitable, because people love us, and because, you know, so you can actually create a company from scratch, from zero. Now, you've all got companies, but you can say, okay, what are we going to do to be the best company? How are we going to do this? And it all starts with your people. It starts with measuring. It starts with rewarding and making sure everyone buys into the plan and they're excited about it, and just dazzling people. And so, I mean, that's why I was really excited to hear about this company where it was the doctor, right?
Yeah.
That came and spoke to you yesterday. Doctor. Here's a person that came up with an idea. You know, it wasn't an airline in Brazil. It was just, you know, clinics in areas where you had, you know, elderly people that needed services and they really needed to be treated well. Created a great, and so you could say, well, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, the net promoter score or the growth? And I'm telling you, his net promoter score is what's driving his growth, because he created a great company where people love to interact with him. And in this article, The Constant Customer, he starts it off by saying, I got four delis on my street. I live in New York City. But there's just one I love going to more than the others. I don't know what it is about it, but when I go in there, I feel welcome. You know, it just I feel this gravitational pull. And so if you can, you know, there are very few companies, you know, in this world where people can say, I love this product. You know, if you say, if I ask you to name five companies that you are just, you know, addicted to, that you love, that you're loyal to. Now, Amazon's one that's come to a lot of people's mind. Well, before Amazon came along, when I'd ask that question, like in business schools, they would say, almost universally, they would say Apple, right? That was a company that people had this gravitational pull to. Well, there's no coincidence that the company that has the most gravitational pull by the most amount of people is the most valuable company in the world. Right? There's a correlation there. It works together. So if you want your company to become more valuable, if you want to create something special, then, you know, it takes a lot of hard work. But it's so gratifying to create a company that people love to work for and people loved and love to interact for. I mean, just kind of one more thing. And then one time I was given a speech in New York City, and some guy came up to me afterwards and he said, you know, I wanted to become a better CEO, and so I spent $30,000 and I went to Northwestern for an executive CEO program. And you know what I learned? And I said, what? He said, well, I learned that if my company matters, then I'm going to do better. I said, like, how so, matters, how? And he said, well, okay, so if my company, and he had a sporting goods chain in New York City, if my company was plucked from the face of the earth and was no longer existed, and my customers showed up to do business with me, how would they feel? What would their emotional reaction be? If it was plucked from the earth and my people came to work on that day and I was no longer there, how would they emotionally feel? Would they go, oh, that guy was so cheap, he didn't give me health insurance, he didn't treat me well, I've been trying to look for a new job, and not think another thing of it? Or would they be devastated and say, I just lost the best job I ever had? Because the more your customer matters to your people who work for you and to your customers, the more successful you're going to be. And that's what I learned. And so he's telling me the story, and I'm like, how does this apply to me? And he said, the one company that matters most to me in my life is JetBlue. And he says, I have a house in West Palm Beach, and before you guys came along, it was just drudgery to travel. It was, you know, I wanted to get out of New York in cold winter Friday nights, but it was just a nightmare. So now I go out there, and Paula is there, and she greets me, and they put me on the airplane, and I watch TV all the way down. You know, now they have free internet, and it's changed my life. And if JetBlue was plucked from the face of the earth, I would be devastated. I got to tell you that. And then he pulls out this little CD and says, and by the way, I convinced Paula to come and speak to, you know, my 400 and all my associates. And she's now, here's a video of her presenting, you know, some of our gate agent working at the airport now is presenting what it's like to do customer service. So, you know, do your companies matter? You know, if they're plucked from the face of the earth. And then I kind of took it one step further, because we all kind of want to matter in life, right? And, you know, kind of like, if you were, heaven forbid, plucked from the face of the earth, would anybody care, you know, if you were gone or not? How many lives have you touched? What are you doing to affect people's lives? Because I think there is a correlation. You talk about business mattering and success, you know, is financial performance. But I think there's a happiness quotient there, too. That the more people that will come to your funeral in tears, you know, maybe that's not your objective. You know, it's kind of a crass, you know, thing. But it's literally the case. The more people that will be devastated by your departure will mean, I think, the happier you are because you're touching more people's lives. And so I think, you know, you can kind of move from business into personal, and I think it kind of all works together.
So David, I know we have some time for questions. I have one question for you because, look, one of the interesting things that when I went from the airline industry to being a surgeon to then into kind of this healthcare financial services space, that I draw back on almost every day is how highly regulated your industry is, right?
Right.
I mean, similar to yours. I mean, you hate the regulations. I guarantee you they hate the regulations. So one of the airlines that isn't on this list I just was thinking about was Korean Airlines. Now, any of you are Malcolm Gladwell fans? You know, Tipping Point, Outliers. Do you remember that story at the start of Outliers where the Korean Airlines pilot puts a plane right into a mountain and, like, nobody told him? Like, there's this, apparently, according to Gladwell, there's some cultures on Earth that are so subservient to authority that they'll literally let a pilot crash a plane into a mountain rather than saying, you're going to kill all of us. And I guess Korea is one of those. So
Brazil had a worse score than Korea.
Yeah.
The only other country on Earth was Brazil.
So they had to bring in other airlines, U.S. airlines, to tell them, it's okay to tell the captain, if you're the co-pilot, you're going to kill us by what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you told me a story just in that vein because, I mean, these folks have to deal with really complicated regulatory environments. So tell them the story about your chief pilot that you told. Remember that story?
Yeah, so I had one of our training captains. You know, I was petrified going to Brazil. Brazil has a horrible safety record. You know, I mean, touch wood, we have never had an issue. But it has a really bad safety culture because when I read the Malcolm Gladwell book, it said basically, you know, there's some kind of test score they give people to talk about subservient of authority, and they said Korean has the worst score on earth. The only one is worse is Brazil. Then I looked at Brazil's accident history, and there are crashes everywhere in Brazil. And I'm like, oh gosh, how am I going to retrain these people? Because, you know, they're just not. There's this subservient issue, but then there was just this kind of Latin, you know, lackadaisical mentality about flying. And so I hired a Top Gun instructor that was at JetBlue. And I said, you're coming with me. You're going to create our pilot training program. And, you know, what we did, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of cockpit resource management where you have, you know, where you have to train the first officer to say something, you know. And but we, what we did is we created this thing called the Padrón, which is our standard box. It was a box that you are authorized to fly in this Padrón. But if you leave this Padrón, then you will be fired.
And so it included like airspeed versus elevation. Like if you can't be below a certain elevation if you're going
right. So one
speed.
Of the things inside the Padrón was that you can't go to flap zero unless you're above 10,000 feet. And it was just, you know, now there was a one in a million chance that if you hit some turbulence and you weren't, you know, when you were at flap zero below 10,000 feet, you could cause an unstable aircraft. So we just went beyond everything. Even though you may burn a little bit of more fuel or whatever, you could not go to flap zero until you hit 10,000 feet. So, you know, obviously there were some people down there that thought this is a little bit beyond the pale and it was a little bit ridiculous, that we should be able to go flap zero at 5,000 feet. So, you know, we have a cockpit, we have a monitoring system on the airplane that monitors, you know, every system and everything that we can review all the data after the flight. So we noticed that this guy who was our training captain was going to flap zero at 5,000 feet. So we hauled him in and we said, why are you doing this? He goes, I was just showing the students that it really wasn't that important, but it really wouldn't affect anything, but I won't do it again. And I said, you won't do it again? What do you mean you won't do it again? He said, I get the point. I won't do it again. I go, well, and he goes, and I'll even teach that it's important and all that. And I said, well, it's going to be a much better example if I fire you than if you stay with us. So you're fired. And he goes, No, but I have 20 years experience. I go, well, you're fired, and I will teach in every class that you were fired for this reason. And everyone will know that you've been fired, and that's much better. So thank you. And then I called in all the first officers, and I said, why didn't you report him? They said, well, he was our teacher. And I said, okay, well, you're on probation, but the next event, you're all fired as well. And then we taught that. And that changed, you know, the culture, it started out that way as the culture. And we said, that's just the way we do it. You know, Steve and I have talked a lot about checklists in the surgical room and how that changed
checklist
things.
Checklist manifesto.
And, you know, I mean, one of the things that you guys don't realize is that, one day I was, you know, and I'm kind of a latecomer to the aviation in relative to what these guys had to go through kind of in the early 60s. But, you know, I was reading this article one day about the Beverly Hillbillies. You know, I was kind of seeing where they all are now. You know, some of us watched that show when we were kids. And I noticed that the mansion of the Beverly Hillbillies, that the owner had died in a plane crash. And his wife was renting it out to make the movie. And that's how she made money. So I Googled his name and figured out. And the guy died in a plane crash flying out of JFK. I said, well, how did the plane crash? And I started looking at that. And it was on a Boeing 707. It was in 1961. It was the third Boeing 707 crash that year. And the other two were pilot training missions where the pilots were being trained. And they crashed. It was like an American Airlines flight, and it was a Northwest flight with a Continental flight where the pilots were killed trying to learn how to fly the flight. Now, you can see why simulators came about. But before they developed these checklists for this airplane, there were over 3,000 people that died in 707 crashes. There were like 40 crashes of 707s, and when that, you know, the 777 that kind of crash landed in San Francisco, you know, the Me Too Low one, and I guess it's in our industry, it's a hilarious thing where the plane was actually coming in too low, and they got that guy did the prank that we got the names of the passengers of the pilots, and they read them. One, the captain is Me Too Low, but it's funny in our industry, but it's probably not funny to you guys. But that particular thing where there was one person that died on that, it was the first 777 fatality in the history of the airplane. Been flying for over 20 years, and it was the first fatality. Because this pilot was just totally being irresponsible as he landed the airplane. So the changes, you know, by implementing this stuff is just remarkable what you can do if you...
So you can have both the Padrón.
Yeah.
The box,
yeah.
But also provide fantastic customer service and still have your people love
right.
you. So you can do both.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, we have our values in our company. We have, you know, our five values, and the top value is always safety. So safety is above everything, because if we have a crash, it's you know, obviously horrible. So
you still give out the scarves.
Yes.
So I know we've got a few minutes for questions. Any thoughts? I mean, again, you're making a transition. Now, back in the 70s, airline industry was regulated, but they deregulated it.
Yeah,
but,
1978.
But you know, they had to make a transition. They weren't great on service. They weren't profitable, right? And they've made this transition, and now I think most airlines are profitable. And yes, question.
I was curious, with trying to instill a new culture, where did you start? Where were the places that you knew you had to start to make sure that you were embedding it in the right places?
Well, I think it's a lot harder to change a culture than if you create from scratch. It's so much easier, 10 times easier. You know, where I'm changing my culture at TAP, thank goodness, I've got a culture over there where it's a lose-lose relationship. The company treats our flight attendants horribly, and they treat the company horribly. But there's a tremendous amount of passion for the country and for the airline. You know, we painted an airplane in the colors that flew in the 1940s, and people just were in love with it because TAP is such an amazing culture. So I think you have to start with passion. And if you have that, that's a lot easier. And so, you know, there are like 5 things I need from the flight attendants to make us a world-class competitor. And all of them don't affect their lives one bit. And I've got 12 items that I'm going to change that completely change their lives. As far as flexibility of schedule, being able to go part-time, just a lot of things that they're going to change it. So, you know, obviously leadership is really important. And you have to come up with... You have to come up with a story, right? You have to come up with something that drives people, where they can drive for a common cause. So be it your values or your mission statement or whatever it is, you have to get people to buy into that. And then you have to have leaders that are leading these people that buy into it, but also, you know, do it in such a way that people want to follow them. And they want, you know, they're servant leaders. They really are there to develop people. And, you know, people in Portugal are saying, you will never convince these flight attendants. You know, one example we have is we fly these A321s, 320s, and 319s, Airbuses. Well, they have, for some unknown reason, said they need 6 flight attendants on a 319. No other airline in the world has more than 5. You have to have 5 by regulation, and they want a 6th one. And then it says in their contract, if they fly minimum crews at 5, they don't do any service on the airplane. They sit there the whole flight, and they'll give them a glass of water, but will not give them service. It's like a lose-lose thing, right? They sit behind the curtains. Customers hate them. They hate the customer. They're just sitting back there going, I love TAP. I love doing this. I hate doing this. My union tells me I have to. So how do you change that whole mentality around? Well, I can't deal with union leadership. But I can deal with the 90% of the people who aren't in union leadership that want to do the right thing. So what I'm doing is I'm calling them all in, and we're sitting down with them and saying, hey, we've got a lose-lose relationship here. We want to make a win-win relationship. We've come up with some really cool ideas by talking to you. What are things that we want to change at the airline that we think we can treat you so much better? Here's some ideas we've already come up with. You tell us what you think. And then they give us all these ideas, and we say, okay, now, for these things, we need these 4 things here. And let me explain how these won't change your life at all. You know, on a flight with 6 versus 5, you serve 8 more people. It takes you 3 minutes on a 3-hour flight. And then you can go sit in the back and relax and not have to feel like the customers are all mad at you. Yeah, that makes no sense. So, yeah, I think it's just coming up with a story, getting everyone on the right page, and then, you know, following through and making it happen. And you can change a culture. It's harder than starting from scratch, but it all starts with a story and vision and leadership and getting people to be excited about it.
Okay, Mike.
I've had this question in my mind a long time. It has to do with the JetBlue and now Azul, I assume, is also a low-cost fare value proposition, if that's correct. My question will then follow.
Yeah.
How can you have low-cost fares and all the extra customer
dazzle
perks that
dazzle.
You like the dazzle for the TVs there have the free bus ride, and if you're late, not just the bus ride, but the car drive home. How can you reconcile the revenue that's coming in, which is less than your competitors, because that's your value proposition, and at the same time do all the extra things?
Well, I think, Southwest Airlines is, an example of an airline that has, like I said earlier, they had at one time, they had a market cap that was greater than all the airlines in the United States combined. And, this is an airline that for, 35 or 40 years has, taken people reliably and safely from point A to point B with happy people on board the aircraft. So, I think, their profit margins were higher than everybody else's. So, can you afford to do some things for people when you're making more than everybody else's? I mean, because there's two factors on profitability, right? There is efficiency, which is the cost side of the equation, and then there is, the revenue side of the equation. So, when I started out with JetBlue, our thing was all going to be about efficiency. I was going to be able, because I had such motivated people at the time when all the airlines were bloated and they were, before all they all went bankrupt and, trying to emulate what we were doing, they had like 170, there was different metrics to tell efficiency. So they had like 170 employees per aircraft. You took their total number of employees, you divide it by their aircraft, there was like 170. Well, we had 80. So we had a lot less people. Our people were making less because they were newer on the job, but they were getting profit sharing checks, which made them be higher compensated because 15% of our profits went back to the people. So using technology, we called it high tech, high touch, and we were developed the first kiosk, checking online, all that stuff that they've all adopted now. It was just new in the industry at the time. So we had high tech, high touch, and we just did more with less. So our costs were just much lower. And so it all kind of drove from the cost side of the business. And then you could have, good fares. They're not today, Southwest Airlines fares are not cheap. They're kind of similar to what the other guys are. But because they've become such a reliable product, they can do that. So the TV was an interesting example because at the time we started, everyone was serving sandwiches on the airplane. And they were giving sandwiches to everybody, and it was $5. It cost us 80 cents for the TV. And I said to myself, well, nobody says, I haven't had a good meal for a while. I think I'll go catch an airline flight. But when they get on the airplane, they go, is this really live television? I can watch my football game. I can do all this stuff. They could care less about the sandwich. They wanted to watch TV. The value is just so much more of a perceived value to the customer. And we saw that our actual revenue per flight was actually higher than theirs was, because people gravitated to those flights because they wanted to be entertained while they were on board.
Well, so then you allowed partners to come in and fill up JetBlue's terminal with great sandwiches.
Yeah,
and encourage people to buy their sandwich over here for $5.
Terminal 5 was a really great, good sandwich. Great cuisine, but and you just encourage people to bring it on.
In the Constant Customer, it talks about how the cost of acquisition goes way down when you have this kind of perpetual Constant Customer, because in that way people are self-referring. And I know that in health plan world, right, you have to spend a lot of money procuring new customers, salespeople, whatever. You have to drop your rates sometimes, all that stuff. But it seems like that might be a part of it. Your marketing costs may go down too if you have a great product. I think next question was over here.
Yep. Well, let me just say one more thing. The word of mouth issue. I remember I was sitting over at Airbus and we were taking delivery of our first airplane at JetBlue, and it was just like leather seats. We had this issue. Leather seats cost like twice as much as a cloth seat, but they last like three times or four times longer. So it was actually cheaper to put leather seats on the airplane than it was to put. I got some hassle from PETA sometime about that. In fact, when I was getting hassled by PETA, someone sent me a shirt that said PETA, people eating tasty animals. We actually switched to synthetic leather labor. You can't really tell the difference, but I'm sitting there looking at the leather seats. Good leg room. Television, brand new smelling airplane, and I thought, wow. And what I really believed is that the disparity between what people were expecting from you and what they got, what they're expecting, the distance between those two is what I call buzz. And when you have buzz, you get tons of word of mouth, and then you don't even have to advertise, because people are running off of airplanes saying, I only want to fly these guys. And I got these letters, you know, where, you know, never heard about you. I heard about this rinky-dinky blue thing. I went and flew you. Now I never fly anybody else. But you have to maintain it. I mean, JetBlue had a really bad summer, and I just got a link from somebody. I'm not really associated with the airline anymore, although I'm a founder, and, you know, it pains me to hear stuff. They made some really bad operational decisions this summer because they were trying to get their cost targets, and they didn't have the guts to make hard decisions. So they took all the spares out of their operation, and their on-time percentage tumbled, and, you know, and I just got an article from someone that wrote, adieu, JetBlue, I miss you, goodbye, I'm never flying you again, you know. So, you know, and I'm pretty upset about it because they, you know, they did make some, now there's issues with air traffic control in New York and runway construction and all that, but they didn't provide for that. And so they've made a lot of customers mad. So you can lose it really quickly as well.
Question over here.
So I'm going to cheat. I want to ask two questions, if you don't mind. And the first one is great what you just brought up because it really gets to one of my big things. As we were working through our purpose and our story around our brand, one of the things that we looked at, aside from understanding from, you know, the voice of the customer, where we should be going as well, was this concept. As you look at these great examples of brands that have done such a great job, usually, or not usually, but those big brands that come to mind, a lot of them, you could probably name the CEO by name, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something about the power of a person like you when you start a brand,
right?
A person like Branson, a person like, and I'm sorry, I forgot his name, the guy from Southwest, you
Herb
know.
Kelleher.
So person like Disney, et cetera, right? Yeah. So I think the struggle for some of the people in the room, and I'm speaking for a lot of people, so they're probably going to go, that's not my struggle, is that we don't have this enigmatic CEO. Luckily, my CEO isn't in the room. Or isn't a founder that has that passion that you have around experience. And although there is some commitment from senior management in terms of they made the right things in terms of talking about experiences, putting it in the C-suite, this priority around experience, when that moment comes around operational cost considerations, it's not as clear that the commitment is all the way down to the DNA of the person.
Yeah. No, that's a challenge. I mean, you know, a fish stinks from the head or it smells good from the head. And, you know, I mean, you can pull out, you know, in a Fortune or Forbes and they do the greatest companies to work for in America. And you can take the top 10 and a lot of you won't even be able to list that's who those CEOs are. But they're great people at, you know, kind of sending that message down through the ranks. It doesn't need to be, you know, Herb Kelleher or Richard Branson, you know. But it does need to be somebody who's absolutely focused and passionate. And, you know, founders are actually more passionate, obviously, than some MBA that just got put in there to increase profits. You know, and that's, you know, that's obviously something you have to fight against. So, but, you know, it all starts from the top, and it needs to be, you know, if there is a customer service culture in the company, you know, and, you know, like Steve started it at Health Equity, then it can sustain itself, but it can easily be lost. And you got to have a leader that's really focused on it. If it's not, it's really hard. You know, it's really hard for you, you know, from where you're at to influence that, you know, unless you can convince, you know, the leader to kind of make this a priority.
So my second question is around when you think about experience, it can kind of be a little daunting. All those places where you can actually make an impact, they can be everywhere, right, in terms of investment. If you had endless pockets, you could do everything. How are you, what are the mechanics other than the survey that you mentioned that you're putting in place to capture voice of consumer information and to prioritize which of those enhancements will make a bigger difference?
Well, I think one of the cool things we do, and I think this is, you know, it's a small sample, but it's so emblematic of what we do. So we've got officers and directors in the company, we have about 34. And they're kind of the ones that lead the company on a day-to-day basis. So I have an absolute requirement, no getting out of it. This is absolutely what you have to do. You're on a flight, you announce you're on the flight, and you talk to every single customer on that flight. You go by and you ask them, how's your experience with the company? What can we do better? And you announce, I want to hear the good, the bad, the ugly about us. And it's just psychologically for those people talking to those, and on average they'll talk to 300 customers, you know, a week or something. They'll take three or four flights. but they talk to them. But it keeps them in touch with the customer. And I think, you know, after a while, there's nothing you haven't heard, really. You get a feel after talking to 400 or 500 people exactly what the state of the company is and what we need to work on. Fares are too high or whatever. You know, you've got this little glitch on your website or whatever. I'm having a hard time redeeming my miles. But it keeps everybody really, really in touch. And it's so easy to have kind of a ivory tower mentality where you sit in there and you don't get down and get dirty with the troops. We also have each one of those people, they have padrino, we call it. They're kind of, they're in charge of a city somewhere in the system, and every quarter they need to go out there, meet with all the people, sit down with them, show them a presentation, and be involved in that city. And they all have these cities they've adopted that they're kind of champions for. And so it keeps them in the field, it keeps them working, and so you know, that's kind of the way we do it.
Let me give you one example. So I'm no longer the CEO of Health Equity. And we brought in a fellow Miamian, came in, different culture. He was from Miami. You know, I'm a good Mormon boy from Utah. He happens to be a good Jewish boy from Miami. He came in and came into Utah, and it was a totally different vibe. I mean, he's trying to figure it out. I was nervous. Right, because I didn't know how John was going to do. Some of you know John; he can be a little quirky sometimes. And you know what he does though, is that he gets on the phones with our member service agents and listens to them speak, and he reads every single comment that comes in. So I think that's our example of getting down dirty.
He didn't do that when he was at his other company.
No, he didn't do it at his other company.
So he was trained to do that because that culture was so overpowering that he realized. He's made a lot of money because he came in and he had stock options at that price. And, you know, he's a competitive guy and he likes having a company with $3 billion market cap and wants to make it six so he can make more money. So he goes, this is really what's making us work. I want to get into it. So he was converted, right?
No, yeah, he was converted and he'll say that. He says, look, I had to learn that.
Not to Mormonism, but.
No, that's. He says, give me another 5,000 years and then we'll talk. That's what he says. Anyway, the question back here.
Yeah, I just have I'd like you to comment on, I don't know, maybe it's only my perception, but it seems like they're in the airline industry, the personal space is getting more and more crowded.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because of social media, we're seeing more and more inappropriate behavior on planes by passengers and such. And I'm just curious to know, is that environment and the pressure for that is impacting experience? How, first of all, is my perception correct? Then secondarily, how do you differentiate yourself in this environment where there still continues to be cost pressures?
Yeah, I mean, it's all mathematics, right? You know, people who can, you know, Spirit Airlines, Frontier Airlines, you know, these are airlines that will sell you a ticket from Denver to, you know, all my kids fly free on JetBlue, but I'm sending them all to Disney World. I send them all to Disney World every year, and we just get together, and we have a daughter that moved to Denver, and we don't have a flight from Denver to Orlando. So my assistant bought a ticket for her and her family for $69. But it was like, she goes, well, the bag, you know, checking the bags are $25. It's half what the fare is. I go, welcome to, you know, the new world of airline travel. And, you know, it ended up being like $100 and $200 each way because of you added on all the extras. So there's these different models, you know, and Frontier was going to go public here for about a $4 billion market cap until United came after them, and now, you know, and so here are the people that came up with a better mousetrap, they thought, and they thought, well, I'll just charge a la carte. I'll squeeze more and more people in an airplane. I'll charge really low fares, and then I'll nick them as they go through the process, you know, for carry-on bag or check bag or a seat assignment or whatever. And so, you know, it's just people trying to figure out a better way, you know, to make it happen. I mean, if you can fit 174 seats in an airplane, you know, in my airplanes down in, I've never had so many seats in an airplane as we do at Azul. I have 174 seats, and then I have a space up front where we have extra legroom where you can pay extra like Delta does, and we started that years ago. But they came up with a new seat that was ergonomically thinner. And so where you actually have more space where you had before because the seat is thinner, it doesn't recline, so it's, some jerk, they're kind of partway reclined, so some jerk's not going to recline right in your face. So there's no recline on them, but they're relatively comfortable, and people can get a really good fare. And so we segment the airplane, and we say, okay, you want to fly with more legroom, you want to get off earlier, you want to pay an extra $50, Sit here. If you want to, if you want to just fly, you're happy to be flying instead of going on the bus. And so this is a way we can get you a cheaper airfare, is we can put you in the back and then charge you, you know, 30 high, so $10 for your bag. It's a way of segmenting, and people accept that because it's a way to get people traveling that had never traveled before.
If you want, I mean, to beat, people, if you want to beat down, sit in the back and sit smile.
Yeah, but if you're like, you know, JetBlue came out with this thing called Mint, which is a lay-flat business class seat, and people ask me, what do you think about your airline doing that? You were so egalitarian. And I said, well, it's really all math. If it takes up 1.5 times as a regular seat and they can get 3 times more money for it, then it's a good business decision. And there are some people that will fly JetBlue that maybe wouldn't have flown them otherwise.
Well, you did it at JetBlue, though. You took out a row of seats. And
we did, yeah. We had extra space up front. So we do that, and it makes a lot of money. I mean, it, you know, charging that extra money makes, you know, at Azul, we collect $3 million a month charging for a little extra for the extra legroom.
Oh, look, in defense of the airline business, you know, I was an airline guy up in Alaska getting yelled at. Then I went to Salt Lake and ran this station.
And got yelled at.
And then I was a trauma surgeon telling people that their family members were dead. And then I was a CEO of a business startup having investors yell at me the whole time. My gray hair came from the airline business. Now, to the JetBlue's credit, maybe this was part of your legacy, instead of beating their passengers, they just pop the slide and go down with a beer and say, I'm done, right? I'm out of here, and they're gone. Kathy, you have a question? I think we're getting close.
Yeah, kind of question, comment. After having flown for 25 years and had lots of different experiences, one of the things that struck me is that as a frequent flyer, when there's any kind of delays or cancellations, you're kind of at this top of the list because you fly frequently. But one of the things that struck me is a lot of people that sometimes I really felt like I needed to get somewhere and couldn't get there, but other times I had a lot of flexibility in my schedule where I would talk to people and they were missing a wedding or they were missing the birth of a first child. People fly to get somewhere to do something. The flight itself for you is the business, but for a lot of us, it's a means to an end. And I wondered if the airline industry, and maybe in some ways the insurance industry, thinks about what's the means to the end that you're trying to get to and the personal experience that's going on, and how do you factor that into your business in the way of customer service?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I started JetBlue, I have ADD. You wouldn't notice, but...
he does.
So I have ADD, and I hate flying on airplanes because I was so dang bored. You know, it was just driving me crazy because... I can't really read a book, you know, and back in the day, I mean, I had my BlackBerry and, you know, and you could maybe try to, you didn't have apps with, you know, stored content and all that stuff. So I just wanted to make it a neutral experience. I didn't want to be so you actually dreaded your flight. If you just actually could look, not dread it, that was my goal. Let's not dread it. Then I thought people would travel more and they would certainly travel more on me. So I think, you know, the means to the end is, you know, going to the doctor or having a healthcare, you know, I think everybody dreads that, you know, to a certain degree. So how can you make it in a way so you can just at least not dread it? So you can make it somewhat so it's, you know, at least a neutral experience, and then for some it will actually maybe even look forward to it, you know. So by things that you can do to make that experience, you know, somehow rewarded, you know. And I think that's, you know, what you have to focus on. You know, it's a tough profession, but I think, you know, what I loved about the airline business when I started, it was so bad that there was so much room for opportunity that I could create, you know, I've created $15 billion of value that exists today, and it was just because it was so bad, and so there was so much opportunity wherever I went. So I think opportunity breeds, you know, it's good when it's bad because it gives you more opportunity.
Dave, we have a question here in the back.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm a Mosaic member, baby. That's JetBlue's VIP.
Hopefully you haven't been.
And I feel very special due to that fact. But, I mean, you guys nailed the basics, and that's awesome. But also the moments that matter. So Christmas last year, the flight was severely delayed. I had 3 kids at the airport, 6 a.m. We weren't happy. But I just realized I totally forgot about that because on the way to Puerto Rico, the flight attendant sang a song and gave everybody candy. And it was just this like surprise, awesome festivity. And that completely erased my irritation around the flight being delayed on Christmas. So that was your fault, but you went above and beyond to rectify it. And then another situation, I was late the person at the desk checking me in ushered me to the front of the security line. And of course, I felt like a big jerk, but I was like, thank you, because I didn't miss the flight. So it's those moments that matter to go above and beyond. And I think in health, it's hard to know, okay, when can we go above and beyond? We got to nail the basics, but we also have to kind of empower people to go above and beyond. So just wondering your thoughts on that, how you've empowered that.
That's the key. We talked about it earlier where, we give every single person on the front line that you make the decision you think's right at the time. And, if it's not, then we'll counsel you and coach you and, give you, but you have, and 99% of the time you're going to be just, we're not even going to talk to you about it because we want you to take care of the customer. If you make a decision to run someone to the gate, we're going to give you a gold star, because we want to delight people. We want to excite people. We want them to tell all 10 friends, about it. And that's what you do. And, that's what it's all about, is making it right with the customer. Whatever it takes to make it right with them. And the more and like I said earlier, if you can make somebody who had a problem with you more loyal to you for having had a problem, that's the ultimate goal. So that's what you got to figure out how to do. That's what makes an outstanding company from a company who's just mediocre or a bad company. And that's not easy, because you got to know you made them mad, first of all, by knowing who that person is, and then you got to figure out a way to excite them without giving away all your profits and losing money and being out of business. So there's a balancing act there.
So I know we're out of time.
Yeah.
So just a couple of following thoughts. So David, when he was doing Morris, there was a book called Moments of Truth, right, by Jan, guy that from Scandinavian Airlines.
Right.
And he used to have us all read that. That's a timeless book about those moments of truth where you can really help a customer. I'd recommend that. As far as leadership, Jim Collins, level 5 leaders, they don't need to be the flamboyant ones. They're the ones that have this passion to succeed. And then just another book I'd recommend. Complete HSA Guidebook. We'll give you a free copy of it for those of you. The 11th edition is coming out here shortly, and we have a link on here. And then one last shameless plug. So Dave and I don't talk about this much, but we actually also own a business together. And our grandfather bought a ranch on the side of Zion National Park in southern Utah in 1962. And, we've done a lot of stuff, but some of our funnest times even now are going down to be at this little resort we built there called Zion Ponderosa. And this year, it was named one of the top 6 adventure resorts in the United States. And I swear to you, this is a little resort in the middle of nowhere. For those of you who have ever been to a town called Orderville, Utah, or Mount Carmel, Utah, we're 15 miles away from that town. And our sister runs it, Julie, David's younger sister, my older sister runs it with her kids. And guess what we do every single time a guest comes? We send them a Net Promoter Survey and we ask them the 2 questions. What do you give us on a scale of 1 to 10? And why did you give us that score? And then we follow up on it. So I think that if you can incorporate, there's nothing I hate worse than having to answer a 15-minute survey. It drives me crazy. But if you can implement something like Net Promoter, very simple, 1 question and then a follow-up, and implement that, I think that is the key to having great customer service. And our Net Promoter Score is in the 50s, 50s, 60s usually, but it's hard to get up in the 70s and 80s. So thank you all. Dennis, thank you, Kathy, and your team for having us, and hopefully that was helpful.
Great.